On June 5th, the town of Elmont, New York, will play host to the Belmont Stakes, and many eyes will be fixed on 25-year-old jockey Martin Garcia. He rode the horse Looking at Lucky to victory at this year's Preakness Stakes.
With a half mile ago, Looking at Lucky, he's out of harm's way on the outside, and there goes Looking at Lucky, he's starting him off.
When Garcia left Mexico for the United States 7 years ago, a career as a professional jockey hadn't crossed his mind. We spoke with Garcia this past week, and he described how it felt to win the Preakness.
I don't know how words to describe that feel. It's just like, wow, it's something that, just like I say, it's just a feel that you never have before. It's just something so, like, so excited that was the way I feel when I win the Preakness.
Getting the chance to ride for renowned trainer Bob Baffert didn't come easily. Garcia says he asked time and time again for Baffert to take a chance on him. Baffert finally did, and it paid off. Martin Garcia will ride another Baffert horse in the Belmont, a mile-and-a-half race. But the young jockey says,
I hope that my horse can relax to go the distance, because I guess horses, they going that far, they need to relax, they need to be calm. I think my horse can do it.
Garcia says he started out riding farm horses as a child in Veracruz, Mexico. But he says his family back home is unaware of his achievements.
I haven't told my family what I do. They don't know that I'm a professional jockey. Why? Because I guess they don't really know what it is.
Martin Garcia will put his talents to the test again this coming Saturday at the Belmont Stakes in New York.
And as Petra mentioned, Poland sketched everything inside the Museum of Modern Art, so it's very likely he came across the work of Peter Carlson. In fact, Peter Carlson's work is on display at
LACMA,
Allegheny County Museum of Art.
Right. Guggenheim, we have pieces in the Met. Whitney, Hirshhorn, the Mall, on the Mall in Washington, D.C., Phillips Collection. Really work all over, almost probably every major museum.
Haven't heard of Peter Carlson? Perhaps you're familiar with the artists whose work he created at his factory in the San Fernando Valley, about an hour north of downtown L.A. There was
a gas station that was all out of faceted stainless steel.
And
a series of bronzes I did with Osamu Noguchi.
He made the most famous piece by Jeff Koons.
The balloon dog, obviously.
And there was Carlson's personal favorite.
That was an Ellsworth Kelly piece, a totem.
Some of the best-known and biggest pieces of modern art have been created right here. Imagine an art studio inside a paint shop, inside a machine factory, inside an airplane hangar, inside a world-class museum. And you have Carlson and Company.
Where we're standing now, you would be seeing, this is where machining would be done, metal parts that have holes drilled, turned on a lathe, that type of thing. As we move along, a fabrication area where...
Up until a few weeks ago, this was one of the leading art fabrication plants in America. The giants of modern American art hired Carlson to build their designs. Artists like...
Robert Rauschenberg.
Rauschenberg.
Klaus Ohlenberg.
Charlie Ray.
McCracken. McCracken.
Some pretty amazing names, some pretty amazing pieces that were... Mm-hmm. Fabricated right here.
Right here.
Back in the early 1980s, Osamu Noguchi was looking for someone who could help him construct some of his massive pieces made from granite and bronze. He was referred to Peter Carlson.
He sent me a mock-up of a piece of work that was out of quarter-inch foam core. You know, it's like a board. You can get it in the stationery store. And he cut up all these pieces that eventually fit together into a piece. He sent them to me apart without any instructions and said, put them together. So, you know, this is a real kind of interesting test. So I put them together and got it really close to right.
Noguchi hired Carlson, and up until the artist's death in 1988, the two worked closely together. In fact, if you visit the Noguchi Museum in Long Island City, New York, many of the artist's pieces made during the 1980s came out of Carlson's factory. In the 1990s, Jeff Koons approached Carlson with a different challenge. He wanted to make a series of massive metal sculptures that, when finished, would look like dogs fashioned from balloons, the now famous balloon dogs. Koons wanted the finished piece to be highly polished.
You could sand it, grind it, and the piece would get progressively smaller, but you would then ultimately realized a very beautiful shape, but it wouldn't be the original shape. So this was a very tough problem to overcome because Jeff wanted it exactly the original shape and didn't want something that was sanded and modified smaller through a deductive kind of forming process.
Sort of the finished product had to be as it began.
Exactly.
It took feats of engineering so complex that even after Carlson described them, I didn't quite understand what he managed to do. But needless to say, each of those five balloon dogs is now worth about $20 million. And then there was perhaps the biggest challenge of Carlson's career, and it came from Ellsworth Kelly.
So Ellsworth had this piece he wanted to do, and he came to me and said, you know, I want to do this very large piece for the Chicago Art Institute. It's there now. It's outside on their new wing, hanging on a wall. He said, how big could we make this? And we could make it bigger than we actually made the piece, but we couldn't ship it.
The piece is called White Curve, and it looks like a fan or a wing made from composite material. And in order to build it in Los Angeles and then transport it to Chicago, the piece couldn't measure more than 55 feet from tip to tip.
It had to go through a very special route through the country. It was followed with highway patrol. It had a route through so it didn't go through low bridges or narrow areas. Very specific route, all permitted.
And last year in April, the piece arrived and was installed in the museum's Pritzker Garden. Now, when we visited Peter Carlson at the factory recently, the work had largely stopped and the factory was relatively quiet.
You know, we're in the process of closing up shop, and most of the activity you see right now is creating and preparing artworks to move out of here.
So we probably 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, could not have a conversation like this because it would have been too loud in here.
It would have been too loud. It would have been very active.
But on a single day, late last month, Carlson gathered all of his 95 employees and announced he was shutting down immediately. He couldn't talk about too many of the details.
You could say that the economy affected us and affected us pretty strongly. I would say, you know, obviously the market isn't what it was.
And that's it. After almost four decades in the business, Carlson & Company is going out of business. The unfinished bulbs of metal, the mock-up of a giant balloon rabbit, a 20-foot plaster sculpture of Play-Doh, they'll all return to their artists. But Peter Carlson's role in the history of modern art has already been immortalized. Just visit your local museum to see it.
Memorial Day weekend has always been a time of change for me. I bought my first car, a 1963 Volkswagen Beetle. In 1981, I said goodbye to you as host of Weekend All Things Considered and moved to New York City to start a family. When I came back to NPR in 1989, it was as host of Performance Today. I had that Memorial Day weekend off, and my family shared a beach house during the summer with NPR colleagues. I also made a station visit to WSCL in Salisbury, Maryland. Since that summer, I've returned to the beach often. Let's just say ocean water runs in my blood. Many generations of my family lived near the sea. Over the 20 years, as the host of this program, you and I have spent many Memorial Day weekends together. But as soon as the show was over, you could find me heading east on the Chesapeake Bay Bridge. Why am I telling you all this? Well, because at the end of May next year, my contract with NPR and the lease on my deluxe apartment in the city expire, and I will hand over this chair to someone new. It's not you. It's me. I've made the personal decision to move to where I have always wanted to live, by the ocean. Over the next year, you'll hear a number of voices in front of this mic while I have the chance to visit as many public radio stations as possible, to meet and to thank you and the station people who have trusted and supported me all these years. My colleagues, on whom I rely more than I can say, have suggested I put together a bucket list of stories to do and people to interview in the time we still have together. I also welcome your ideas. The countdown begins today. And as always, this is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen.
As the oil continues to gush into the Gulf of Mexico, BP engineers are scrambling once again to find a way to stop it. This time, they'll try to put a cap on the blowout preventer where that oil and gas are shooting out. A pipe from that cap would then divert oil to a ship. Meanwhile, BP's still drilling two relief wells that they hope might be able to kill the spill deep underwater, but that could take up to 2 months to complete. NPR science correspondent Christopher Joyce is one of our reporters following the engineering side of this story. Chris, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
So BP has started out trying to cap this gusher with a containment dome. That didn't work. Then they stuck a pipe into the well. That didn't work. And obviously pumping drilling mud into it didn't work either. How is this cap going to do better?
Well, hopefully they're learning from their mistakes because obviously the big containment failed because of unforeseen circumstances that got clogged up with crystals. This one's going to fit much more tightly. It fits right over the top of this so-called blowout preventer. If you've ever bottled beer or anything, you know that you take a bottle cap and you squeeze it on the top of it and you can pretty much seal it off. This won't be quite that tight, but it's the same sort of idea. And hopefully that'll divert enough oil so that they can then buy time. If that doesn't work, then the next option down the line is to put yet another blowout preventer on top of that and do the job that the first blowout preventer didn't do. I mean, it's Rube Goldberg ad infinitum.
Chris, I want to ask you about those relief wells. These are being held out as a kind of last resort, right?
That's the eventual way to kill this whole thing. I mean, all of these things are stopgap until they really kill it.
But, I mean, they have to hit what is essentially a 7-inch target a mile under the ocean. Explain how that works.
Finding the noodle, the one noodle at the bottom of the haystack. Actually, I'm told by petroleum engineers it's not quite as horrifically difficult as it sounds. In the last dozen or 20 years or so, they've developed something called 3D seismic imaging. And with vast computer power, they can image in three dimensions miles and miles of area underground. You look on the computer, it looks like a big box, a big cube. And they know right pretty much where that pipe is. They know all the sandstone layers and all that. So they're drilling down. The drill bit is basically an intelligent object. It knows where it is at all times in the XYZ axis, like a 3D compass. So you navigate them, and it's kind of like navigating a boat. If you know where you started from, the dock, you know how fast you're going and how long you've been going, you can pretty much know where you are at any one time. So they can get close. Then what they do is they create a magnetic field out from that drill bit. The sandstone is invisible to the magnetic field. But what shows up? Pipe. So they know with that magnetic field exactly how to hit that pipe.
And that basically sucks the oil into the well.
Well, they got to drill a hole in that pipe. And no, what they'll do is, and then they'll do the same sort of forcing mud and cement into the original wellbore. But again, this is really tricky. They have to hit it at the right angle. If they come in from the side, they're not likely to get enough pressure to force the mud and the cement to block up that hole.
Could they conceivably make a mistake that would cause the spill to become even worse?
Well, people don't know a lot about that wellbore, the original wellbore. It's supposed to have cement casing around it. And there's a metal casing and cement around it. Did the cement set properly? If not, you could cut into the wellbore, but then the oil and gas could then divert up into what should have been the cement casing. So it's really hard to tell.
That's our Christopher Joyce from NPR Science Desk. Chris, thanks.
My pleasure.
This past week, the Government Accountability Office released a startling report on the herbal supplement industry. Dozens of supplements were found to contain traces of contaminants like lead and pesticides. Oftentimes, they're manufactured overseas in factories that are not inspected by U.S. officials. But the GAO says what's more important is the way these supplements are marketed. Manufacturers aren't allowed to claim their products cure disease, and they certainly aren't allowed to suggest that ginkgo biloba or ginseng can replace prescription medication. But in many cases, that's exactly what's happening. Here's an audio clip from a conversation between a supplement sales rep and an undercover GAO investigator.
I think I can stop taking my my meds and just use this?
What a lot of people do, it's like, you know, they start taking both at the same time, and then slowly you will stop taking the other prescription medicine and just continue with this.
Greg Kutz is the head of the GAO's Forensic Audits and Special Investigations Division. He explains that his investigators told sales reps that they were suffering from diseases like diabetes and cancer.
We use those scenarios to test the marketing of storefronts, websites, and others we called across the country.
Now, what kind of claims can a supplement manufacturer make legitimately?
They can make these structure function claims. For example, fish oil may improve or help you with your heart functioning properly versus saying that fish oil can cure heart disease. That would be the difference.
One of these sales reps told one of your researchers that taking a ginkgo biloba, combining it with aspirin, will improve memory and will fight the symptoms of Alzheimer's. But apparently the NIH says, the National Institutes of Health, say that this combination could cause internal bleeding. I mean, how common is it that these manufacturers are making claims that could actually be dangerous?
We don't know how common it was, but it wasn't hard to find those types of claims well more often than not that we found either deceptive claims or the dangerous medical advice.
What power does the FDA have over supplements to sort of regulate them?
They have the power to regulate, I believe, the structure function claims and to some extent the labeling. The other player here is the Federal Trade Commission, who can get into the deceptive or misleading marketing.
Well, how can consumers be protected from this?
Well, hopefully our report, getting the word out to consumers to be careful, to consult with your doctor before you actually take a dietary supplement and to make sure you understand that if there was a cure for cancer for $10 a bottle, it would be actually have gone through a drug approval process.
That's Greg Kutz. He's the head of the GAO's Forensic Audits and Special Investigations Division and one of the authors of its new report on deceptive marketing practices within the herbal supplement industry. Greg Kutz, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
So why are herbal supplements so difficult to regulate? For that, we turn to Bruce Silverglade. He's with the Center for Science in the Public Interest. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So what is the answer? Why can so many supplements consumed in the U.S. by adults and babies and children, why can so many of those be produced, for example, in Chinese factories that are not inspected by the Food and Drug Administration?
The reason is a 1994 law that the supplement industry lobbied for, which essentially deregulated the industry. These products are essentially unregulated. The claims on the labels generally go through no FDA pre-market review, and instead the label carries a disclaimer that the claim hasn't been evaluated by the FDA. But that's a cop-out for government.
I wonder if there is a risk that some of these unregulated supplements could actually pose a public health risk.
Well, I think most certainly. And in addition to the claims being, you know, grossly exaggerated, often untrue, there's the question of just, is the ingredient safe for its intended use? And the FDA has to go through a lengthy court or rulemaking procedure that can often take almost a half a dozen years sometimes in order to take a potentially dangerous product off the marketplace.
The supplement industry is estimated to be worth about $25 billion. Does that give them a lot of power, a lot of lobbying power here in Washington?
The supplement industry's political power in Washington actually comes from various segments of the American public. And it's an unusual issue, politically speaking, because the supplement industry derives a lot of power from the right wing, from Republicans who just don't want to see any industry regulated, but also from the Democrats on the left side of the Democratic Party that are usually the friends of consumers on issues of this sort, but often favor alternative medicine, complementary medicine, and from that philosophy have come to the conclusion somehow that the dietary supplement industry doesn't deserve to be regulated.
That's Bruce Silverglade. He's the Director of Legislative Affairs at the Center for Science in the Public Interest. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Memorial Day weekend is the gateway to a season of fresh produce and farmers markets. The bounty offered is bound to bring out the chef in all of us, and who isn't looking for new things to make? Sophie Dahl has just published a new book of recipes for every season, but it's not just a cookbook. Miss Dahl's Voluptuous Delights is also part memoir. Sophie Dahl is the granddaughter of the actress Patricia Neal and the late Roald Dahl, author of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and James and the Giant Peach. Maybe that's where her passion for food comes from. Let's find out. Sophie Dahl is in our London Bureau. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Hello, hello.
Hello. So where does your passion for food come from?
I think I grew up in an incredibly greedy family. So it would have been odd had I been a sort of meager, moderate eater. I was just surrounded by foodies.
Was your grandfather, Roald Dahl, a foodie?
He was. He was rather greedy. And he was a chocoholic. He knew the history of every chocolate bar ever made. And at the end of every meal, there was a red Tupperware box that was always ceremoniously brought out. And that signified the time for chocolate.
when he died, the family buried him with chocolate, if I'm not mistaken.
He was buried with his favourite things, like a Viking. So he had chocolate, a few fine bottles of Burgundy, and his snooker cues.
He's prepared.
Yes.
He is.
Off to have fun in the afterlife, yeah.
You bet. You write so lovingly about your family in this book. You have a grandmother. Is it Gigi?
Yes, Gigi was my paternal grandmother, who I adored, and she was the person probably who taught me to cook. She was a great baker. She was an ex-chorus girl dancer. She was 5 foot tall and all of it leg. I was wearing her clothes by the time I was about 8.
You know, I'm looking at the back cover of your book, Voluptuous Delights, and there is what looks to be rhubarb and just this decadent whipped cream over it and a fork
is stuck in it. That's a rhubarb-eaten mess.
It is a mess, but it looks fabulous.
A great sort of frothy pink, yes, blancmange mess. It's so delicious, that.
It looks so decadent. Where did you get the recipe for this?
Eaten mess is a very English pudding. It's made from a base of meringue, and it's normally made with strawberries, but I love rhubarb, and I have very nostalgic memories of rhubarb. Both of my grandparents grew it in their garden, and I used to eat it, sticks of it dipped in sugar when I was a child. So I thought about doing an eaten mess with a mess of a rhubarb compote on the top.
Rhubarb is such a spring, summer ingredient. I mean,
it's heaven.
It is.
Total heaven.
Turns things pink, and, you know, I've even seen like jellied rhubarb, and it looks like something out of a fairy tale sometimes.
Yeah, it's that brilliant alchemy of food. And I recently made a rose petal sorbet and mixed the rose petals with the glycerin, and you suddenly just get this hot, hot pink colour. And I think the joy of cooking is one still does get that childish feeling of excitement from the magic of it.
Home food. It brings back home. Your spring section of the book is set in New York when you were modeling.
Mm-hmm.
Now, being a model, I mean, you were asked, do you want to do plus size modeling?
Yes.
But then you had an encounter with the ne plus ultra fashion photographer, Steven Meisel, who did some wonderful things with you. And the summer portion is you're back in the UK. But I'm wondering, as a model, a professional in the fashion industry, what's the history of your own relationship with food?
I mean, it was always a very straightforward one, really. I think it wasn't until I started modelling in England when I was 18 that, and because I was rounder then, I was an 18-year-old with puppy fat, so I was very much an anomaly in the fashion world. That was the first time I ever really started to think about food and my appetite, and it was quite confusing because in England I became hailed as this crusader for curvy women, but I was a teenager, and I suppose as a teenager you want to fit in with everyone else and you want to be able to fit into the same size jeans as your friend, and that's about as much searching and as goes on into sort of one's feelings about one's body. So it was a very strange thing.
But in New York you started a raw food diet for a while.
That was a strange and short phase which did nothing but make me enormous because I'm greedy. I thought, oh, well, because it's raw, I can just eat as much as I want of it. So I was sort of scarfing down great plates of almond mousse and nut milk-based avocado ice creams. And I got rather carried away. I did have glowing, lovely skin, but a rather big bum.
I'm speaking with the writer Sophie Dahl about her book Miss Dahl's Voluptuous Delights. If people were coming over to your house at one point this summer and you were going to do, let's say, a Sunday lunch for them, is there a recipe in this book that you would choose?
If it was a summer Sunday, I would probably do the barbecued salmon, which is a whole salmon on a cedar plank. And, you know, again, you can put some vegetables on the grill with it. So I would do asparagus and some courgettes, some eggplant.
I'll tell people courgettes in this country.
Oh, yes, zucchini. Yes, I've got zucchini. I managed the eggplant bit.
You did.
Which would have been aubergine here, but yeah, I forget. I also always struggle with coriander versus cilantro. My cookbook had both in them. I kept having to be corrected. And what pudding would I do from the book? I would do probably a sort of delicious orange almond polenta cake or an Eton mess.
An Eton mess, yeah.
Yes.
Back to that Eton mess.
Back to the Eton mess.
So now that the book is published, what are you going to do next? I mean, you're writing, you're cooking. the world is your oyster, to be cliche.
I'm writing another cookbook and, you know, writing a bit of fiction here and there, a bit of journalism here and there. So it's lovely getting to do the two things that I really love. So the writing and the cooking.
Sophie Dahl's book, Miss Dahl's Voluptuous Delights, is out now. And she joined us from our London bureau. Thank you. Happy eating this summer.
Thank you so much. Happy eating to you, too.